This week on Retronauts, we're moving beyond the studio system. Best I could come up with. Sorry. Hello and welcome to a special Retronauts. I'm your host, Kevin Bunch. I'm reporting in from the Vintage Computer Festival East in Wall, New Jersey. I'm sitting down with a real Cosmac VIP, a pioneer of video game and indeed indie game development, Joyce Weisbecker. You can introduce yourself.
Hi, now. I can now jump in. And yes, I'm Joyce Weisbecker. I'm the first independent video game developer because I did the Speedway tag game for the RCA Studio 2 TV console, which my father designed and developed and designed the microprocessor in it and wrote the Ship 8 language that was used with it and did many other things.
Yeah, I've been acquainted with Joyce for some years now. I'm really excited to have you on. I've been kind of interested in like having you come in and talk about some of your experiences, but I'm like, well, I don't know how easy it is to like set up a recording, but the fact that we happened to both be here made it perfect. So I'm really excited to talk about that. And, you know, you mentioned your father, Joe Weisbecker. He was really a computer and gaming pioneer in his own right during his tenure with the American consumer electronics giant RCA. He did a lot of other stuff outside of RCA, which we'll talk about as well. But platforms powered by the 1801 and 1802 microprocessors, those were kind of his babies, like the Studio 2, Cosmac, Elf, and VIP, all those sorts of machines. Like you said, you wrote some works for those, and I'm excited to talk about those as well. Longtime listeners may remember way back in 2020, the podcast had an episode talked about the Studio 2 and the Fairchild Channel F, but you know, since RCA's history is of specific like fascination to me, I'm really happy to give it its due in a whole episode. And I'm really excited to do it with someone who had kind of a front row seat for a lot of those activities. So let's jump in a little bit. Like, what were your first experiences with computers?
Well, let me address what you just said about had a front row seat. Actually, I was sitting backstage as my father was doing all this.
Oh, that's good.
More like that, because I'm family, and he was always talking at the dining room table about what was going on at work. That was the part that was not so upsetting that he went upset my mother. Like, you know, I hear rumors of layoffs. We didn't talk about that at dinner.
Right.
But things that were going well and interesting things that other people were working on at work. And then, of course, if my sister or I showed any interest in what they was doing, he was like, go on and actually explain what he was doing. And I was the one who was more interested in it. My mother was an elementary school teacher. She was interested in behavior and people and education. And my sister took more after her. I mean, she wanted to work with animals and work with children. She wasn't really interested in working alone, isolated in an office somewhere. And I was more like my father and said, we don't really need social contact. You know, if we have to work three days in a row and never see another person and to get a project done, that's fine. We're not missing anything. Just
perfect.
Different personality. Yeah. Right? So different interests. And I was really interested in the things my dad was showing me. I wasn't interested in building hardware. And my father was always interested in building the things that he did. And I was only interested in the theory behind it. He was interested in the theory. And then he wanted to design something that pushed beyond the known theory to see if it would work. And I wasn't too enthusiastic about spending the time learning the skills to actually build something just to see if it worked. So when I discovered you could mathematically describe the behavior of something and prove that it was going to work right just doing math, I said, I'm learning math. And then my father pointed out that, you know, computers do math really easily. I said, whoa, that's it, computer programming, because computer modeling and simulation of devices sounds like a faster way to get through a lot of projects than actually building things mechanically or electrical circuits just to see if they work.
Yeah.
So I wasn't really introduced to programming. I was introduced to the idea of designing things and testing to see if your ideas worked. And then it was sort of like, yeah, but if you can describe the behavior mathematically, computers can do the math for you.
Much faster.
That's what I say, it's much faster. And then when you want to show it to someone else, you can just turn the computer on, and you don't have to remember exactly what you did to make sure you do the equations right and solve them right in front of someone.
Yeah.
That was very appealing.
I can see that, yeah.
So that is the, I sort of came in the back door to programming. It's like, do you want to learn how to do carpentry? Do you want to learn how to do hydraulics? Do you want to learn how to do electrical circuits? And it was like, I want to just, you know, design things and test to see if they work. Ooh, maybe you just want to describe your project mathematically and then write a program that simulates it. Ooh, yeah.
Perfect. Yeah, I get it.
And again, that's video games too.
Yeah.
Because they're simulating something you do with the real world. They're just, you know, they're just not devices. They're sets of rules, you know, or the graphics. Mm-hmm. The same kind of thing. So it was like, oh yeah, and I can do computer games.
Yeah, I mean, it's all math for computers. They're not worried about the specifics of what you're trying to
do. Now, unfortunately, it was hard for me to admit that to my father, and it was very nice and tolerant of me. Okay. We were watching a sitcom once, my sister and I were young, and it was all about the pressure from your parents to do what they want you to do and not. And at a commercial break, my father turned to me and my sister and said, you know, your mother and I are successful people in our own right. We don't need to live vicariously through you two girls. So don't worry about whether we expect you to disappoint us or anything. If you don't pick up on the hobbies we suggest to you, we only suggest them because we were interested in it. And there's probably something that's an inheritance thing. So if it's something we like, maybe it's something you'll like. But if it's not, it's okay. We're not doing it because we want you to do something for a career. We're just saying, oh, I find this interesting. Maybe you will too.
Yeah, but,
you know,
I get it.
No,
you know,
no pressure.
I have a small child at home, and you have to introduce like your hobbies and see if he likes them. Some of them he's really into. He really followed my wife on enjoying to artistic measures. But also, he likes to mess around with computers and animation and whatnot.
And like, you know, my sister had more of my hobbies than my mother had. I had more interest in the hobbies my father had. But in both cases, they were a little different. My sister wanted to be a veterinarian instead of working with children.
Mm-hmm.
But it's still, you know, interacting with things that interact with you and relationships. And I wanted to do the different kind of programming. I wanted to use the computer as a tool for programming. But my father was more interested in the hardware. So he taught me a lot about the hardware. But it was sort of, it wasn't a disappointment that I wasn't going to hardware. It was more like, darn, I thought I had someone to hang out with and pursue the same hobby with. And no, okay.
It was just sort of an incidental interest to you.
Right. You're hoping for someone who has exactly the same thing. You'd have another hobbyist enthusiast with you.
Yeah.
And it's just similar. It's okay.
Yeah, that's fine. And, you know, your father, he liked to tinker. You know, and he worked in RCA on computer technology. That was sort of his big thing. I remember digging through some of his papers and seeing, like, materials he had, like, proposals for, like, a mini computer, work on the Spectra 70 line, and memory was one of his...
One of the assignments at RCA was not only control logic units for the mainframes, but researching memories. And you think, well, how much research do you go into memories? But it wasn't modern memories. It was magnetic core memories.
Mm-hmm.
And it was before magnetic core memories. Different approaches to building memories that he was researching.
Yeah.
And even when it was memory systems that they're already used in IBM computers, part of the research was, okay, the yields are horrible. So how do you have circuitry around it that during a test procedure identifies bad bits and programs around it so that the programmer never knows which are the missing addresses? So he had, that's the kind of research he did. And again, control logic, a little test and circumvent the bad memory locations with making it transparent to the end user.
Yeah.
So it's a little more than just like, you know, memory physics kind of thing, memory architecture.
You know, You've mentioned, like, in our previous conversations when we, like, recorded an oral history for the Hagley Museum, that your father was very interested in, like, magic. And that seems, like, in that line to me, just, like, you don't have to know what's going on behind the curtain as long as it seems like it's working just fine on your end.
Which was why my approach to, hey, if you know the math, you don't have to build the, seem natural to me. Because, yeah. I mean, I guess if you actually like carpentry or engineering, you miss the not building it part. But if the goal is to prove to someone it will behave in a certain way, and you could do it with math and convince them of it, mm-hmm. then you could build it when they wanted one. It seemed natural to me because I was raised by a magician. And he said, you know, I don't want to give any spoilers. So is it okay in the podcast if I give away a couple of secrets of
Go
magicians?
For it.
Okay. They don't actually make things appear and disappear.
I am shocked.
I know, and I hate to leave that out in the public, but you know, it's a small group of insiders for the podcast, so I think I'll safe, and the word won't get back to the magic community who left the cat out of the bag. But it's all creating the illusion that things are disappearing and reappearing when you inflate coins mm-hmm. and cards, and you know, so when you're raised with someone who's showing you that and trying to get you interested in that, from a person who's not interested in the performing, he's more of a student. He says, I found out through performing, giving magic shows, things, I'm too nervous to be a professional performer. So what I found out what I liked about magic, I'm a student of magic. I like studying how the tricks are done. I like thinking of new tricks, but I don't want to be a performer. So I'm a student of magic. And so I knew it was okay to be a student of some subject and actually do final products in something else. But if you use the same techniques that he used to say, designing the control logic unit of a computer feels like inventing a magic trick, because you go through the same process, you picture the audience reaction, the effect you want to create in the illusion, and then you figure out how to create that illusion in their mind. And the computer is the greatest thing. When he read about them, he knew that's what he wanted to do for the day job. He goes, it's just on-off switches that turn on and off other on switches in a clever arrangement, a lot of them. And it creates the illusion that it's doing something else. No one looks at the computer and says, oh man, that's a lot of on-off switches going on and off in intricate patterns. They look at it and say, it's doing this.
I can play pool on this thing.
It's playing this game against me. Okay, it's formatting a document. It's sending something to the printer. No, it's not. It's turning on off switches in patterns based on patterns of other on-off switches. It's just whoever designed that circuit, it looks like that's what they're doing, because if I type in two numbers on the keyboard and I get out the addition of those two numbers, there's no adding circuit. There's a circuit that switches things. And it happens to be certain bit patterns create another bit pattern out. And then someone has cleverly arranged it. So the two separate bit patterns that represent numbers, the output is always the addition of them, or if you hit another signal, another mode, another circuit is the subtraction of them. Mm-hmm. It's just really cleverly solving the problem of, if you get this pattern as input, what pattern you want as output, and that behavior people interpret as, oh, that's what happens when you add two numbers. So it must be adding.
Yeah.
I mean, and that's everything. And my father read about computers. Yeah. Man, that's it. It creates the illusion that it's doing something more by a cleverly done digital logic circuit. And he said, after a while of thinking about it, he said, wait a minute. This whole book is talking about why everyone would want to buy a computer and use one. The illusions they're talking about happen to be that it's doing useful work, which means you can get a good paying job doing this. And no one says, oh yeah, the stage illusion that you can produce is that it, you know, got payroll done. It looks like you saw the lady in half and restored her.
Yeah.
No one says, hey, I got a stage illusion that looks like the payroll got processed. But a computer, you can give the illusion it can do payroll processing.
Yeah.
And you can do the illusion it's solving equations.
And I think that really like factors into some of his like early work with making games and like books and such to try and introduce computing to like kids and the broader public. You know, he did the Thinkadot, which was reasonably successful, like a little board. I guess it's not really a board game.
A plastic toy.
Plastic toy, yes.
It's plastic flip-flops.
Yes.
In a digital logic circuit.
Yep.
And you're right. Everything was, once you realize that all you're talking about is you'd like to work with a programmable circuit that is just on-off switches, there's no reason you can't use other representations of on-off switches to in little circuits to introduce people to the idea that, well, if you did more of these and more complicated, you'd be designing computers.
Mm-hmm.
And just like I like baseball card trading when I was a kid. So I was forever sorting them into numeric order, figuring out which ones I was missing, and then sorting them back in by team because the kids in the playground wanted to trade you by team. So I was always sorting, and I got some cards, I resort. And I got really good at inventing sorting algorithms that were more efficient because I had to. And then I went off to college and I got a class in programming and they had names. It was bucket sort, it was insertion sort, and they were saying why things were, and other people, oh, you know, and they're asking me, how do you remember that? And I'm picturing, wait a minute, that sounds familiar. I decided that laying everything out on the bedroom floor and leaving space for the gaps and trying to, so I could fill in the cards, insertion sort, at some places I would run out of room. And then so I decided I'll deal them out in stacks of zeros, tens, twenties, of the 250s, and then I'll hand sort those and then pile them all. Oh, you know, this is a known solution to sorting algorithm. My father had to say, you know, he said, yes, he discovered that in his life. Some things you do, you say, wait a minute, that sounds familiar. Here's the general algorithm for doing that. But you had the problem, you solved it yourself, trial and error.
Yeah.
And you came to the same conclusion. He said, so he wanted to have toys and games and puzzles in kids' hands, so that when they play with them, someday later in their life, when they run into it in digital logic or computer programming, they're going to say, wait a minute, that description sounds familiar. I've done something like that. I understand it.
Wait a minute.
Right. Yeah. So it wasn't so much he wanted to teach people about computers and digital logic. He wanted to have practical experiences that involved digital logic or the kind of thought process of writing a program.
Hmm.
So that later on, when you encounter it, you recognize that's all they're talking about. Stuff you already did. It makes sense to you.
Yeah, and I think, you know, that sort of interest in education through play is very important because, you know, when he started building his own, like, hobby computer around, what, 1969, 70, thereabouts?
Okay.
Like, that,
He's been designing this computer since 1953. So when you say, when he started...
Fair enough.
Which project do you mean that the technology was finally there to make it a practical end product as opposed to it's the same design philosophy and theory throughout, waiting for the technology to let you implement. But again, the toys and the books are because the only technology you had was injection molding plastic or printing
right
on paper. So his stuff was digital logic represented on paper and pencil or in plastic flip-flops.
Yeah.
And it wasn't like during that time he wasn't designing a small computer.
So he had been designing this for years prior to actually starting to build it.
Yes. What he said on the first date with my mother back in 1954 or 55, I have figured it out once from which one, but it was the fall. He was going into his last year at Drexel in the five-year co-op. Mom had just graduated and gotten her first teaching job as a third-grade teacher, and they met at the fall at a dance. Back in the days when there were actually places you went, and the dance, so you can meet people. And they were at the dance, and you're there as a mixer, so dance with her. And mom asked him what he's doing, and he said, well, Drexel Co-op student, electrical engineering, and I'm working on the BizMac, with a huge computer, rooms full of equipment, and computers are really great, I'm really lucky to have this, this is all I would do for a living. He says, and it's just on-off switches. So, but it's really... Yeah, it's what you do with the on-off switches. And it's really fascinating and that's what I'm going to do. He says, and the great thing is, right now, it's three rooms full of equipment on a computer, but they're really useful, and they're going to get smaller, because there are only switch on-off switches. So physicists are working on making small, fast, cool-running, tiny, small, fast, cool-running, reliable on-off switches. And so they're coming. So you can design a computer that could be small, that is large now, but you can't design a computer that's large now that could be small. He said, so the only difference is at some point, you still need to have people interact with it, which means wires that are full size, which means as you shrink three rooms of equipment down the palm of your hand, you don't care with three rooms of equipment. If every terminal is connected and every tape drive is connected on its own wire, it gets down in the palm of your hand. You want as few things directly connected as possible. I'm working on designing that part of it so that you can still make a mainframe, but they'll automatically shrink down with the architecture. And Mom said, oh, fast, slow, fast-running, slow, low-power switches. Why aren't you working on that? My father said, because I'm not a physicist, I'm a control logic designer. So that's not the fun part. I'm not going to spend my life not working on the fun part. And Dad said, at that moment, I realized I'm marrying this person. And my mother said later, I took one more date to be sure, but I was pretty sure he's the one I'm going to marry. Because up till then, everybody was very childlike, immature, and they first found... The first date they had with somebody else who was actually a grown-up, and not just a grown-up, but not resigning, miserable in their life, a grown-up who had enjoyment that he'd get out of life and knew how they were going to work that around a day job. And a person who said, yeah, that's great. That's who I want to tie in as a husband. Someone who is not going to wind up a miserable son of God, soured on life in 10 years because he chased money in a way that he hated.
It does not have a hobby that brings him any joy.
Well, so. My father also said, he said, you can choose your hobbies and exactly how you do it. So you might as well choose a hobby that might bring in money.
Yeah.
You know, so if you like something, figure out those same skills in something that you could sell in the slot. If you don't make any money off it, it was a hobby anyway.
Yeah.
But maybe you do.
So he's starting to design this, and then...
And he said they'll be in... they'll be everywhere when they're small and cheap. They'll be in your refrigerator. They'll be in your toaster. They'll be everywhere. So at the time when I hear these stories and you're a kid, you don't think anything of it because you don't know computers. But now looking back, people are going, oh, when did people first start thinking to make embedded controllers out of computers?
At least since the 50s.
My father read about computers. And he said, when they're small, you don't need to be data processing. You can be controlling things.
Yeah.
And the only reason they're used for data processing only is you can't use $2 million and three rooms of equipment to control an industrial process. But if it's a $2 part that fits in the palm of your hand, you can build the computer right into your industrial equipment. And the only reason to do it is to control it.
And I think that this is good because it sets apart what makes the unit he was building at home, the FRED, flexible recreation education device, kind of really sets it apart from what people generally considered computers at the time. Because
it also explains why everyone says it had a very unusual architecture.
Yes.
Well, if you're designing a microcontroller in the days of mainframes, you're going to wind up a very different architecture.
It is a very
and everyone else is coming up with.
I remember when I was talking to people about the FRED architecture, and they're like, yeah, it just has this really big scratch pad memory area, which is very strange for a microprocessor, but it really worked out here.
A Well, you got a scoop. Your podcast has high. Evacuate the building. We have a threat called in.
Yes. Sorry about that little break off. We apparently had a bomb threat at the event, so they had to evacuate the building. So the rest of this will be brought to you from my car.
From the safe distance in your bomb-proof car.
Well, I don't want to test that, but...
let's not tempt fate.
We'll go with that. So, where was I when before we kind of broke off?
We were talking
about the FRED, the flexible recreation education device, and how it has unusual architecture,
right.
Like the large scratch pad, because, like, it's not super fast, so you want to be able to do a lot of things in one time.
Oh, that's an interesting statement. Oh, that was the reason for what you think?
I'm working off of my recollection from interviewing other people who worked with the machine, yeah.
Right. Would you sort of like to hear?
Yeah, I'd like to hear more.
What I heard was the explanation for the scratch pad register.
Sure, go for it.
In order to keep the gate count low so that RCA could do it in CMOS, which the gates were all larger and you couldn't fit as many on chip. Plus, it's early days.
Yeah.
And it's just the next step up from medium scale integration. So, the in-house capacity to RCA is not a huge amount of gates. To keep the gate count low, he's looking for everything that doesn't require hardware and you can push into software. And he's looking for a hardware architecture that uses the fewest gates.
Mm.
He said, so one of the things is you wind up with a general purpose scratch pad memory. And if you need extra variables at the machine level language, at machine code level, you can use them as extra variables, as extra registers. You don't need to give people, hi, here are your registers for temporary storage. Okay? And you can have multiple program counters, so you get multiple stacks.
Oh, well, here you go.
Okay. And the X register is a stack for doing calculations on. The P register is the program counter. I'm sorry, let's use software term. The pointer. X is the pointer to the register you're going to use to keep track of stacks and arithmetic operations for operands. P is the pointer you're going to use to get the program counter out of the register stack. And N is anything you're currently using in the instruction that has to say a register. I like to specify a register with the instruction. N holds what that instruction says, which register you use. And if you're not using a register, N is a parameter that gets decoded, like what math operation or logic operation you're going to use. So you can have a small instruction word and dual purpose. The other part, instead of the opcode, the parameter is either the what register you want to point to, or it's the additional opcode you need for a really complicated operation. Most computer architectures, they just give you more registers. And they say, this is the register you have to use when you use this operation.
Mm-hmm.
And not only does it make it a longer opcode, okay, and it also means that you have more gates because every data path has to be hardwired in. Every opcode has to be decoded to something that says that register to that other register. Whereas if you just have a table, a lookup table, and you've got three registers you can use to point to the lookup table, you know, he tested things, tried things out. Three pointers into a lookup table is perfectly fine.
Yeah.
You know, you don't really need to get that much more complicated.
and
it gives you the opportunity to implement stacks and push down pop-up stacks because you don't have to save a pointer to the program or something else you're doing. You have one register that points to where the stack beginning or end is. So that and other people's solution was a longer instruction word and more circuitry.
Right. And you know, his initial unit, this was pre microprocessors on integrated circuits, so it was all like TTL logic, transistor logic.
Yes. He was hand wire wrapping all the gates himself.
Yeah.
Which is why you want as few as possible.
And I've seen the pictures inside of the prototype unit, and it is just a nightmare of breadboards and chips.
It actually looks like robins attacked a rat's nest.
Yeah, that is a good description.
It's inside a box. It was in the garage. You open it up, and the rats got in and pulled things, and the birds got in and started making a nest. And there's some little structure to it, but obviously it was whatever wires the rats dragged in kind of thing.
But you know what I really appreciated is, like, it's kind of forward-thinking in its design, too, because, like, this original unit, it had, if I was reading the documentation correctly, 1,024 bytes of memory, which, you know, at the time was not a huge amount, because, like, a mainframe like RCA's own Spectra 70 that had anywhere between, like, 4 to 512 kilobytes of memory.
No, the entry-level Spectra 70 had something like 50,000, 64,000 bytes. And some IBM mainframes started out earlier generation, the 360, had 4,000 bytes.
Oh, were they already
on memories? I mean, mainframes started out with a couple dozen bytes at most.
Right.
Because it's new technology and the RAM is expensive.
Okay.
So it's a constant cycle. The new technology is always limiting in the same ways because it's expensive to do. So you limit. You have the limit in the same way.
But what interested me is that the architecture he set up for this machine could read up to like 64 kilobytes.
Of course.
Which is like,
because unlike Bill Gates, he was not going to tie the hands of anyone who's going to use the system and say you'll never need more than this much memory. So therefore, there's only one way to address it, and you can only address it up to this much.
Yeah.
And that was the whole design philosophy. If you, at any point, you had a decision to make that would limit what you could do with something else, you push that in the software, and you left it up. At the time you write the application program, do it the way you need.
Mm-hmm.
And I say, his design philosophy was, make it easy to explain. It's going to be lots of pieces connected in complicated ways, so you're never going to make it easy to understand. But if you made it easy to explain what's going on, then people would dive down into each piece themselves and could figure it out and were motivated to try. After wire wrapping the first two prototypes, the System Zero and the Fred, he said, I'm glad I'm doing a microprocessor.
Don't want to have to deal with this anymore.
Right, because I never want to wire wrap a prototype of this CPU again just to try out a couple ideas. He said, and I'm double checking to make sure that the part that goes into the chip is only the part I never want to change and is tedious and I just need to wire wrap it again just to get back to play with the interesting part. And I want all the interesting parts to be pushed into software so when I can buy one, I can try out different ideas that I had in software. I don't care if it runs slow. I don't have to build it again. And I want to make sure I don't accidentally lock something into the hardware that I wanted to play with an option later on. So that's why so much was pushed into the software, because he said, you know, I'd like to buy these things and play with additional architecture designs, how many stacks, what sizes, different things. I don't want to accidentally push some of that onto the chip and then my hands are tied.
Right. Yeah, and I mean, shrinking this down from like, what, 14 or so TTL for the microprocessor down to like one or two like integrated circuits for the microprocessor itself once they do the integration. Mm-hmm. Like that's pretty huge.
Yes, yeah. Yes. But that's what he saw coming for a medium scale integration.
Yeah, this is all
and working
like
in mainframes. He saw how much you could shrink things down and that they were still working on shrinking it even more.
Yeah.
So he could sort of judge.
It feels very prescient in how he was approaching it, which I appreciate.
Well, it's not. The interesting thing was, after the 1802 actually got out, one day he said, you know, right place at the right time, born at the right... Charles Babbage was not born at the right place at the right time. He had the right ideas and no way to implement them. Because with mechanical switches, the friction will kill you. There's only so many things you can do and turn a lever, and everything turns a response. Okay, but his ideas were proven to be right. He says, "I lucked out because I really thought at the rate transistors and semiconductors were going, I was hoping that very large scale integration would come in before I retired, so I would get to do all these things on a chip." He said, and all of a sudden, man, those sons of guns—they're really good. Once he got medium scale integration, you got VLSI like before anyone expected. You know, there's no telling when you solve the problem, practical problems, But once they solved it for medium scale, it turns out like, man, everyone said, oh, is that what works? Okay, I think we know how to solve the rest of the problems. let's start building fabs. He anticipated that it would happen someday, but he was completely surprised by the fact it happens decades ahead of what he thought it was going to take to work out the practical problems of semiconductors.
Babbage and Lovelace would have loved an elf. I did want to touch, what brought the Fred to RCA, and it's like a sort of a series of events, like a cascade, if you will. So, RCA was in the computer business. We've talked about the Spectra 70. We talked about, what your dad was working on. And, according to contemporary reporting, RCA wanted to make a major effort to overtake IBM in the computer market, which was absolutely bonkers because IBM was much, much bigger than every other player. But they had a hope.
Yes.
And they spent an absurd amount of money on this effort.
Yes.
Around 69, 70.
Consistent with what I heard from my father, yes.
Yes. And from what I was reading, this is really driven by people who worked at IBM and came to RCA and were like, well, we could just beat my old employer.
I have ideas for a better thing. Let me be in charge and I'll be the IBM slayer.
Yeah. And it turns out that they couldn't slay IBM because IBM had a lot of advances going on in just computer technology that RCA did not have the capacity to really keep up with.
That RCA was not willing to research so fast that they could keep up with IBM. They were willing to look into it, but not with the scale that would have got even close to IBM, let alone overtake them.
Yeah. The way Robert Sarnoff, who was the president and CEO of RCA at the time, put it in the press, is that it would take a $500 million investment over 5 years to compete with IBM, and they did not want to throw that kind of money at it.
Yes.
So they, in 1971?
Yes.
Yep. They,
Fall of 71.
Fall 71, they closed the computer business. You think I would have written down that date in my notes, but I did not. But
I did review before we came. September of 71, I see press announcements.
Yep. They sold their computer business to the UNIVAC makers, Sperry Rand.
And I wonder, where were they headquartered?
It was Massachusetts, wasn't it?
Oh, was it? What a coincidence that 3 years before IBM had announced they're moving the computer division to Marlborough, Massachusetts.
Yeah.
Not that, as my father suspected, it was a sweetener for a potential buyer who wanted to see how much of the staff went with it if they moved. No, no, it was IBM, all these reasons, RCA had all these reasons, good reasons that they were relocating to Marlborough,
absolutely.
Massachusetts.
Yeah, it's definitely nothing to do with Sperry Rand.
What a coincidence is how things worked out. Isn't life funny?
Digital Equipment Corporation being up there.
Yes. All sorts of potential buyers being located there.
So now you had a bunch of people who worked on computers at RCA. The company just took a $250 million write-off on the whole division. What are they going to do next?
And it's worse than that. It wasn't just the people who worked on computers who didn't move with them.
Yeah.
It was the entire semiconductor division, solid-state division in Somerville. What I remember hearing is that between 25 and 50% of all their sales were in-house for RCA mainframe computers.
Yeah, that would check out.
Right? Because they're transistorizing, making semiconductors of different cards in their mainframes, and they're the ones fabricating them.
Yeah.
So they lost a good chunk of their revenues when they didn't have their in-house customer anymore.
Mm-hmm.
So it wasn't just the employees looking for what's the next thing. It was like, to avoid layoffs, the semiconductor division was looking for new products.
Yep, and your father, he had one right there. You know,
That's why I said right place, right time.
Yeah, I remember hearing that he talked with Jerry Herzog, who was his boss, sometime before the closure of the computer business. And he sort of just was talking about this Fred machine, and his supervisor's like, well, I bet you could use that as like a microprocessor as an in for RCA.
That's the impression you can get from the bits and pieces. What happened, Jerry Herzog was in charge, high up, I'm not sure how high up, but high enough up to have a say in things. In the semiconductor division.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And my father, when they announced that they were moving RCA up to Marlborough, Massachusetts in the fall of 68, saw the writing on the wall, and he talked to my mother, and she said, look, if you want to move us to Massachusetts, that's fine. And not really. It moves the kids away from all the family on both sides of the family. And, you know, it's not like it's job security for life with RCA. Right. You know, even if they don't sell the computer division, who's to say in 5 years they're not getting out of it anyway? And now you're up in a strange town with no relatives to move in with. And, you know, you're on your own. Let's not. So he said, you know, I have a chance because the semiconductor division now needs products. And a computer on a chip is a semiconductor product.
Yeah.
So this might be a good time to convince them that maybe you'd like to do a computer on a chip. And all this talking about, oh, I have good ideas for it, and I'm sure it would work, isn't going to cut it. I have a tight deadline to convince them before I have to start looking for a job. Because at some point, if they even stay in it, they're going to tell the cabinet employees from the computer division, either move tomorrow morning to Massachusetts or leave.
Right.
So the clock is ticking. So my father said, I got to actually get an 8-bit microprocessor design done. So started seriously in 68, and by the summer of 1970, he had one built, the System 00. And next thing was, he talked to everyone he knew in RCA and said, hey, I got an 8-bit computer that I built in my basement that I only has like 6,000 transistors. It would fit on two chips that RCA can make at their current capabilities. Anybody interested in doing this? And word reached Jerry Herzog in the semiconductor division, because he's too high for my dad to know and call. But
right.
He talked to somebody who was in there who passed it up. And Jerry, it turns out, well, again, right place, right time. He was a physicist who had started RCA when transistors are coming in and had worked his way up in management during the whole thing and was actively engaged in the research and work in transistors and semiconductors. And it turns out that his goal in life was to actually solve all the practical problems of putting an entire computer on a chip. And RCA was moving that way as they were transistorizing and putting a semiconductor, more and more of the boards in a mainframe. And as it just didn't look like he was going to get to do it, they got out of computers. And then someone says, well, you would like to put a whole computer on a chip? I got a little one that'd do it. And surprisingly, yes, call him up and say, he said, the only problem is management is gun shy about computers because top management just said, we're not in computers anymore. He says, so we're going to have to tell them we're just building a semiconductor chip, but not call it a computer. And I said, yeah, I'm not sure about, you know, we'll have to think about it. He says, no, Jerry says, I got an idea. RCA is in the business of making custom printed circuit boards for industrial control. And the semiconductor division has been told that's a very profitable business. We want to generate more business in that.
Good news.
Right. So maybe we have just discovered the answer to their question of how do we get more business and grow the custom printed circuit board business for OEMs of industrial equipment. Perhaps, he said, I'm thinking along the lines of we tell them it's a semiconductor alternative to custom printed circuit boards with digital logic. And the cost savings is going to come that you have one standard chip that you do in high volume, and then you're left with only one semiconductor chip that's custom for the customer. And that's it. I think they'll buy that.
Yeah, I mean, it's technically correct.
And it's a microprocessor and a ROM, you know? But if you don't say it, and you start out talking about the custom printed circuit board control logic business, you're actually talking about a microcontroller and a ROM, which is an entirely different concept than a data processing system that competes with IBM.
Yeah. And I believe, correct me if I'm wrong, because I'm pretty sure I've read this, at least in like some of the oral histories and such, is that computer games was an early idea for him to like, as a use case for this thing, because what better way to expose people to computers than a game, because that's something you understand.
Okay, now the question again is how early do you think, because when he first read about computers and he wanted to build the minimal part of a computer that does the programmable part just to see if it worked, and he realized how many pinball machine relays that was going to take, he gave up on it. And then on a trip to the Franklin Institute, because he loved science museums in the Franklin Institute, he saw they had a they had a relay pinball machine. Relay tic-tac-toe machine. And he saw the size of the box. And he says, oh, if someone, you couldn't look inside it, and they didn't say how it was done. He says, but that doesn't matter, because I see the theory behind this thing. And he says, and it fit inside a reasonable sized box. So someone figured out how to do it with a reasonable number of relays. So he built himself a tic-tac-toe machine.
Yeah, that was like what?
53, 54. Yeah. Right. And in the Hagley Museum archives, there's a picture and a write-up about Asterisk One, which is the next generation tic-tac-toe machine, which shows the wiring diagram and the theory behind it. Yeah. And how you did it.
And I think at least one of those machines, is it the Strong Museum now?
Yes, I donated the original prototype, the original one he built, to the Strong Museum of Play.
Yeah, I remember.
I couldn't find any documentation on it, but I sent along the Asterisk documentation because it's the same thing in a different box.
Yeah, I remember when they got that, a friend of mine who works there sent me like a message. She's like, do you have any idea like what I should put this under? I'm like, well, that's probably this machine. Okay.
I'm glad you said that, because that's what I say. When you said the idea of doing games on a computer, well, the first example he did when he couldn't do a general purpose computer was a fixed game using digital logic.
Yeah.
So at what point are you asking, when did he think of doing games as an educational outreach? Since the tic-tac-toe machine out of pinball machine relays was, it hooked him. He was already primed to be more interested in that when he saw it at the museum, because he already knew about switching networks and logic with relays.
He already knew it would work for him, so yes. Clearly it would work for other people.
And right.
He was right. He was very correct. You know, because this is RCA, and before we started recording, you were talking about how RCA had a patent on the CMOS process.
They developed CMOS technology as proprietary. Yes. So they wanted, the money in RCA was licensing the intellectual property, not actually going into manufacturing. Mm-hmm. So they did a lot of research into things like flat screen TVs out of vacuum, out of CRT, out of tubes.
Yeah.
Because it probably wasn't practical, but you'd find out an awful lot of useful things and get a lot of useful patents to other industries along the way, which they could license and make money that funded the research.
Yeah.
So they would do these, what looked like pie-in-the-sky research projects, but they might develop into something else, and they didn't. Someone else might be able to license the patents and do something with it. So there was still funding. So that's RCA management's mindset, is if it looks like you'll make a lot of breakthroughs on the way to solving the problem you want to solve, you can make money off those breakthroughs even if you don't exploit them.
Yeah. And, let me start that part over there. And what's interesting to me is that they had this CMOS process, at the time there was also other, you know, IC technologies like PMOS and NMOS. Mm-hmm. And NMOS is what a lot of other microprocessors from the 70s ended up using, because it tended to be quicker
and smaller. Like in the late 80s or the early 90s, I finally read in a trade magazine, and it's the latest whatever microprocessor on it's CMOS, of course, because it's so much better than everything else. And I said, ooh, let me go back and read the articles in the 70s that RCA was fighting the reputation that CMOS is a dead end technology because, yeah, it has some nice advantages over NMOS and PMOS, but the deal breaker is each gate is so much larger, you'll never be able to fit enough on a chip to do anything practical. And that's just going to kill it. So you might as well go NMOS and PMOS. And yeah, they admit there's a lot of nice things about CMOS, but it's not practical and it never will be. And then like 20 years later, it's like, well, of course it's CMOS. Everything has done that because it's so much advantage. When you have real estate to spare on the chip, yeah, go with
it. Yeah, miniaturization really worked out great for CMOS eventually.
Right. But so RCA was fighting that reputation in the industry that you shouldn't go CMOS because it's not practical.
Mm-hmm.
So the semiconductor division was tasked with trying to find enough chips that enough circuits that would fit on a chip with CMOS to be practical so that you could compete and say, hey, there's plenty of room for this many transistors on it. And if you use them CMOS, it performs so much better than the competition, who, yeah, has a lot of extra space in their chip. But what do you care if you have extra space on their chip? Doesn't benefit you.
Yeah.
So that's what Jerry Herzog was saying. I'm tasked with finding more CMOS chips we can do. Somebody has my pet project, a computer on a chip. And he says it's few enough transistors, you'll probably be able to fit it on RCA CMOS circuits. He said, we're pitching that because I think we can get that through. Just don't call it a computer. Call it really complicated control logic. And so it's big because it's general purpose. So we can customize on the other chip for the customer.
Which is exactly what they did, really.
Right.
And I know that, it took a little while for their fabrication technology to really sort of catch up with that concept.
Well, they were only doing in-house.
Right.
And they were only doing converting printed circuit boards for their mainframes as much onto a chip as they could get. So they didn't really need to push what they could put on a chip.
Right. So it took a couple years before they actually had, like, the equipment and everything so that they could actually compress this into first a two-chip microprocessor, the 1801, and then the one-chip 1802, which is really confusing with those numbers. Like, they make sense. But
okay, well, you want another confusing thing?
Go for it.
I came across an in-house RCA publication about progress reports through the year and what had happened, and I saw a sentence I'd never seen anywhere else that explains a lot of things about it. It says the 1802 is being announced that it's either had recently or will recently be out in test quantities.
Mm-hmm.
So this is a year summary in the announcement. And it says, unlike the FRED and the 1801, we had to go to a bit slice architecture to fit it on the 1802.
I have no idea what a bit slice
right.
is.
But what it is it's not TTL. And it's not the same architecture. It's not the same circuit design internally. So when you see the disk, the die image, you're not going to find things that go with the wiring diagram of the FRED or anything about the 1801.
Hmm.
The block of register RAM is going to be there. The I/O lines are, but the internal structure is going to look different because it's not TTL circuits. It's a bit sliced approach to the logic design. Okay, and that's just out there for the guys who are trying to, like, look at the die and say, I can't spot where the logic blocks are. That's because they're not looking for the right kind.
I bet there's some hardcore hardware nerds on this.
Oh, that's why I wanted to put that out there.
That are very excited.
This is a hint as to why you can't match up what you see on the die to what you think the architecture is. It's a different architecture than you think.
Mm-hmm.
You got an exclusive on your podcast.
There you go. But, like, it's not like they were doing nothing while they were waiting for this, like, hardware side to, like, spool up. Because they were, like, experimenting with these FRED units. They built, I think, was it 14 of them at RCA? Something like that.
My father never knew an accurate count because, like you said, I am not wire wrapping another one.
Right.
Let the other guys at RCA try out their ideas for differences in architecture I/O by wire wrapping one from scratch. I'm waiting until the 1801 comes out, and I am making FRED prototypes where I can start with a two-chip 1801, and then play with additional options.
I think there might have only been, like, 7 wire wrap models. It's in one of the books right. I've seen, but it doesn't really matter
I'm
how many
saying,
there were.
The first wire wrap FRED is his. Wire wraps are other people, and then when the 1801 chip is available in test quantities, you know, some are dad's, some are somebody else's.
Yeah. I've seen a lot of the different, like, prototype 1801 machines that he built for playing around with.
That's because the enthusiasm for being able to play hardware options now that you didn't have to wire wrap the whole darn basic thing to get to the point where you had these. It was so great that everyone couldn't wait to do it.
So, like, that staff at RCA, they were working on stuff like a 16-key keypad that, like, plugged into where the card, the punch card reader mm-hmm. was on the, like, the original unit. They developed a light gun.
Oh, my father did that for FRED.
Yep.
That was, you know, the gravity feed card reader and the light gun were dad's suggestions for the kind of peripherals you could have with a system like that to show that just because it was simple didn't mean you were locked into only doing simple interfaces of simple devices.
And the light gun is neat because I saw in the documentation, like, he was writing about the Magnavox Odyssey's light gun, and I believe the prototype at the College of New Jersey, I don't know if it's the prototype, but there is an Odyssey light gun in there, and I'm kind of wondering if he just, like, converted it to use something.
Oh, no, no, no. He bought it to see how they did it.
Oh, okay.
Okay, and he saw how complicated and expensive it was going to be. He sat down and did another one, did it another way. And when you look at the wiring diagram in one of the Fred notes, if you look at it, it's like, oh, darn, I thought this was going to be a nice project. This is like nothing. This is like, oh, I want to wire up a battery and a switch and a light bulb kind of level of complexity.
Yeah.
And explain to me, my sister, how it worked. He said, to be reliable in a home, you have the power supply is a 60 hertz hum throughout everything, which could kind of flicker in the screen. But you can't perceive it, so no one bothers it. However, you have a light gun. You have to know if you're looking at a target or not, and you have to account for the fact it might be flickering.
Yeah.
Fast enough that the LED that's sensing the light can vary with it. So you have to cope with that. He says, so what he does is the games that use the light gun, the target flickers slower than 60 hertz a second, but still fast enough that it's not perceptible. So when you're pointed at the target, it knows that the frequency is right, register hit, and if it's pointing at anything else that isn't that frequency, you're not hitting it, which allows you to have more than one target if you want to change the software, so it looks at two different frequencies.
And this way you can't just point it at a light bulb and win automatically.
There you go. It doesn't matter the ambient lighting, the glare. You think it's mysterious how it does it. How does it know that that's the white dot that I want to have as the target? But to the if you're fast enough responses, it's the flickering white dot at that rate.
My other favorite thing is, like, they developed, like, standards for saving and loading onto cassette, which, thank God, better than punch cards. Oh. But the big thing for me that I find really fun is that they used this cassette interface to get sort of audio in some of these games that they were working on. Because they were making games for the Fred at RCA and apparently at your house as well.
Oh, well, they're the best demonstration of the power of the computer in a way that people are actually interested in watching the entire demo. Yeah. You know, that's how my father looked at it. Yeah. You need a demo that shows off everything you can do with it. But you need to do it in a way that people don't get bored halfway through, or they can see that it has to take something to do it, you know, that it must be complicated and the computer has lots of capacity to do different things. And games, like, you know, fit the bill.
Yeah. So there's one that really comes to mind because the former curator of the College of New Jersey's Sarnoff collection, Flory Pierre, got to deal with a lot of these tapes.
Oh, are you going to say, yes,
it's the
bane
bowling.
Of her existence, yes.
It's the bowling tapes.
Right.
But there's a few of them, like these early Fred ones, where they'll load the program, and then the computer will tell the tape to stop, and then when you actually throw the ball in the game, it will play a sound that your father recorded in a bowling alley, of just a sound of a ball going down and hitting pins.
Yes. I like to describe it for the people who think they're old, but we actually consider them young. It's the equivalent of a CD-ROM game where you have full motion video.
Yeah.
Okay, it was before you had video. This is audio, live recorded audio that you play in the middle of your game, and you don't have to generate it.
It's the original multimedia experience.
Right. I like to think of it as the guys who do full motion video stole the idea from the audio people on a cassette tape. Oh, we have a CD-ROM now. We can put video in with it.
Perfect.
You know, skip to it, play that, go back to where you load the next level. Same idea.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And, like, a lot of these games are emulated. Like, you can play them. Marcel van Tongeren?
Yes.
I hope that I'm pronouncing that correctly.
I am not going to attempt to it, because I can spell it, but I don't want to insult Marcel by not pronouncing the name.
But he's a lovely man in Europe, and he made an emulator for all of these, like, platforms called EMMA02, which has its own website. If you want to try any of these out, we have digitized a lot of these programs, and, like, he's got them as binaries. They're bundled with the emulator, which is very nice.
And I just would like to thank Marcel for all the work he's done and everyone involved in getting the tapes saved and convert it and preserve. Because the car called EMMA 2, the EMMA 02, an emulator, is really doing injustice. Okay? It is a museum of software for 1802 systems that were publicly available systems.
And some that weren't publicly available.
Even a few that were in-house development things. But practically every system that was ever available to the public based on an 1802, it emulates the software for that.
Mm-hmm.
And it also explains things and has a documentation with it. So it's more of a museum of software for 1802 systems than just an emulator that handles lots of different machines.
And you know what? If you have the WAV file for these bowling games, you can have that same experience if you want to, like, futz with the emulator, because it does, like, emulate all the switches and everything.
And another part of that is that as I set my point up to go through the artifacts they found and try to identify the physical artifacts, and I happen to be there, and Perry is working on splicing audio tapes and recording, and while I'm there, Flory says, by the way, you know, we have these tapes, and they're not Fred tapes. You don't want them back? Are they, you know, your family tapes or something? One says Christmas music. And I said, you didn't play? No, it says Christmas music. I said, no, it's pin 8 for the Super Sound Card. It's Christmas music for the VIP.
Yeah, the Cosmic VIP.
If you play it, it's a program. It just plays music. Oh, okay. And she says, I have this one. It's a woman's voice on it. Is that, you know, family member you want? I said, no. That RCA had bought Random House. So my father was pitching, you can use it for educational materials because they publish and you publish, you know, books with it. And here's how you could use computers. So he had an example of educational materials that included stop and start for voice. And he says, your mother has a nice speaking voice. And she's a third grade teacher. She has street cred among the educational materials people at Random House.
Yeah.
So I had her record the audio, and it was like the program would load, and they would give you audio instructions of what to do, and it pause until you did it, and then the tape would advance to the next section. And if they quizzed you, you had it right. You'd have a voice saying that was right or that was wrong. Try again. Again, you skip ahead,
mm-hmm.
and you have to really look at the circuitry for the cassette interface to know how you could fast forward out playing, and the computer knew you skipped the section and where to start again. And the only problem is you couldn't rewind.
Right.
So, hence the bowling sound effects. If you're going to play bowling, you can only play as many games in a row before you rewound the cassette, reloaded the game, as you had sections of the same rolling down the lane and hitting the pins sound.
I do remember hearing the story of the, because they actually did take one of the Freds out to test the educational materials.
Oh, I hadn't heard about how that went.
Oh boy. So,
yes.
I believe it was Tony Roby who was explaining this to me, because I think he was the one who got roped into it.
I know my dad had nothing to do with it.
So he went out to a few different schools, I think in the Philadelphia district, and it didn't go so well because they needed a power outlet for the computer and a power outlet for the TV, and I think they needed an outlet for, like, something else.
And the cassette recorder.
Yes, and most school districts did not have that many outlets in their school rooms. So he got there and was like, I can't plug all this stuff in because there's only one outlet in here. I guess I can't actually do anything with this. So they shelved the whole thing, but the thought was there, and it probably would have gotten somewhere because, like, schools were using teletypes in this time period.
Oh yeah, they were leasing time on a mainframe or a minicomputer at a nearby university.
Yeah.
Who would loan them the teletypes, and California. That was a huge thing for People's Computer Company, mm-hmm. the newsletter, David All and the Three-Headed Dragon.
Yep. Well,
that's what his target market was at the time. It was high school students who had access to a university computer through a teletype machine.
Yep. Dartmouth time sharing system,
right.
Same thing. But, good idea. Didn't quite work out.
Well,
but,
an idea that was ahead of its time.
Yes. Well, we can go with that, because the Fred could have been the Apple II of the 70s if the infrastructure was there for it.
Well, no, because it was never designed for high performance. Mm. And all the successful home PCs for video game for computer games and the video game consoles did really good performance, and they pushed the limits of the performance.
Well, I was thinking in terms of like the Apple II in the mid 80s was not a very like high powered machine at that point.
Right. But it was still intended to be more high power throughput than the 1802. The 1802, remember, my father's vision of mainframe computers was eventually they would be handheld microcontrollers built into equipment.
Which is not wrong from where the things stand now.
Which is a certain style of game different than running a game on a full-fledged computer.
Right.
Yeah. So, yes, there were some kinds of games that it could compete it with, but really, you need a... And again, I don't want to start the age-old war here of... Do you want to design your video game, your computer game on a computer platform or the video game platform? And each time there's a new generation of PCs, it's better to play it on that because it works. And then the next generation of consoles comes out and it's better than the PC.
Yeah.
And they keep leapfrogging. but yeah, you need that kind of future power.
Yeah.
And that wasn't the design goal of the 1802. The design goal was adequate performance and cheapest cost.
I do want to note that you also wrote a game for this Fred computer, like, in these early days, and your father sort of brought it to work and showed everyone and, like, wrote about it in some of their memos of, like, here's what games we have. So, like, I'm curious, what got you to, like, working on the Fred and, like, playing around with it?
Oh, yeah. No, my father treated me just like an adult, you know, as my father... I'm going to channel my father now. I hear my father's voice saying, or maybe it's more like the guys I worked for were more like 14 and 15-year-old kids. So, so I treated you the same because you were a 14 or 15-year-old kid at the time. know, I mean, I can't let that go when you're talking about my dad. I hear my dad saying, no, actually, this is how I'd phrase it. and I'd hope it get back to the guys in the group. Try to deny it. We try to hide it from RCA management that it's like, hey, it's a bunch of kids playing with this stuff, and you're allowing us to play with all this stuff, but we don't want management to know, so we act like adults when the management comes around. So, yes, he included things I did that he took in, just like anyone else in the group's contribution of, here are some games that will run on the Fred. Mm-hmm. And when the VIP came out and they needed... I was almost going to say they needed games for the manual.
They didn't want games for the manual.
As you know, that would not be a proper statement. That would imply RCA wanted something. It's my father wanted games in the manual because he'd always use games as to demonstrate the capacity of the Fred.
Which is something that RCA developers did, like, even before the Fred. Like, when they did their open house in the 60s, they had their computer pool game and their computer maze game, because they knew, like, people are going to want something they can understand and not just a bunch of, equations.
And speaking of that, they had an exhibit of how does electricity work? And they had a whole exhibit with little dioramas of showing you Maxwell's demons pushing the electrons down the device, and they had every device, a resistor. And the little Maxwell's demon cartoon cutouts were pushing against really hard against the resistance. And they were doing seesaws on the capacitors. And it was a little display of window box by window box of exactly how all these electronic components work. In terms of Maxwell's demons pushing electrons and showing the kids who came by, see, this is how it works inside. This is why they work.
Oh, God.
So in the tradition of that.
Yeah.
And then, he said, okay, so here is my draft copy of the instruction manual, and here's where the games are going to go. In the program listings, we have these games tentatively to go in it. And RCA put on the brakes and says, No. And that, you've seen the demos. We always have. It makes a direct demonstration. It motivates the person who buys this to put these games in. So they have something to show their family and friends, And we want things like, the combination lock and, it's a logic probe or something. All the practical things you could fit in something really small.
All the hits.
Oh, yeah. All the things that, I'm going to show my neighbors that.
Yeah.
This is a really cool thing I have. But the reason they were adamant against it was, my father said, and I brought it on myself. The way I pitched that you even do the microtutor and the VIP was because you can't say it's hobby computer because that's too small a market. He said, so the sales pitch was, this is a self-study course for engineers who work for equipment manufacturers who the company wants to get into microprocessor controllers. This is a self-study course. Now, we'll go out and do training, but if you work at a smaller company or you're on your own and you want to learn it, we need an affordable, self-contained self-study course in embedded microprocessor design, including the hardware interfacing to it. Okay. And we might as well sell it to the public.
Yeah.
For parents who want to buy it for their kids to learn about it. Too, to increase sales, and hence the games.
Let's see, the microtutor, it's like an 1801, it's like the training computer, but it's not too fundamentally different from what the Cosmac VIP was really designed around.
Nothing is fundamentally different from anything.
Yeah.
Because it's what you're able to do cheaply with the technology at the time. So the microtutor was the two-chip 1801 bare-bones version of what then became the ELF.
Yeah.
And the VIP, if you look at it, actually looks like an ELF with all the expansion cards that my father wrote about actually built into the printed circuit board for the motherboard with the new expansion boards put in slots.
Mm-hmm. I did make a note of that.
Yes. So it's not just it looks similar. That was the design philosophy. It was, we can't do it yet because the parts are too expensive, so we'll strip it down to an ELF.
Yeah.
And then we'll show you how to make your own auxiliary circuits to it. But it's designed, we can just get it out there, Rob, because at some point we're actually going to build it on a motherboard, on one printed circuit board, but we're waiting for that to be cost effective, and that'll be the VIP.
Yeah.
But in the meantime, here you go, build it yourself.
Yeah, that's the other fun thing that's worth noting, is the ELF is not an RCA product. This was something your dad wrote about for Popular Electronics in a series of articles. Here's how you can build your own computer using this 1802 microprocessor from RCA, and here's some of the cool stuff you can do with it.
And again, it's my father's philosophy of, you want to do something that's like this, or you want to build a kit, and I'm going to make it so that in order to build the kit, you have to learn how everything works.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I'm not going to give the option of just learning how to solder things together according to the schematic, and it works and you can't explain it. Okay, I'm going to explain assembling the kit in a way that along the way you understand how everything works. So when you show it to someone, they say, how does it do that? Or how, you can just tell them because you learned it as you went.
And
as opposed to saying, and if you want to know how these, refer to this book or, this textbook or something. And he even has a little sidebar of how to program it.
Yeah, and this was an era when people were, if they were getting a computer at all, because it wasn't that easy, it was out of a kit or how to build it yourself.
The only affordable way, because you couldn't afford the parts alone, let alone paying someone for the assembly.
Yeah. Yeah, like, I remember reading something. It's like, yeah, you could get an Elf pre-assembled, but it's going to be, like, $500.
Yeah, right.
As opposed to, like, what, $250, well, $270
yeah,
for all
like,
the parts?
Yes, yeah. You could buy a Volkswagen, but if you want to assemble it, it's going to cost you another $1,000.
Yeah, So, like, it's actually been pretty prolific as, a hardware design because, like, they weren't here this year, but I know in previous VCFs there's been someone selling, like, here's an Elf and an Altoid.
Yes. He couldn't be here this year, but we're hoping he comes back next year.
Yeah. It's like, and there's still Elf, like, user groups and, like, I think not, is it Google Groups? It's whatever
It used to be Yahoo Groups, and now it's groups.io.
That was it.
Cosmic
yes.
Elf.
Yes. And they're very busy there. Oh. I think I'm a member, but I don't have their, like, notifications on because there's just so much email traffic.
Well, between the replica kits that are out there and people want to add things on in interfaces and say, I'm having trouble with this, you know, can you advise me how to expand it? And the people are saying, I want to put this in my basic kit and do a printed circuit board. Anyone else want to buy one? I have to do it in a minimum of 10 pre-CPs. Anyone want it? And yes, yes, yes. And can I get the entire set of parts with it? Oh, yeah, okay. It's very active.
Yeah.
Okay. And I just like to say, if you look in the VIP instruction manual, I think it's page 20, mm-hmm. at the end of a chapter, before they get in there, at the very last paragraph, in the middle somewhere, it explains that they're using the latest technology and the way the architecture is done on it, with a sentence that says, this computer should not be obsolete soon.
Should not.
Right. will not be obsolete soon. To assure you that if you buy this, you know, it's not going to be somebody else next year and a passing fad. But, I, you know, and the way they phrase it, I have to look it up again. But the VIP will not soon be obsolete. And I'm looking at it, and this was printed 50 years ago this year. So I'm thinking, I think we can say, yeah, that prediction came through.
Yeah. People still finding uses for it. Oh, man. But, like, this wasn't the only thing. Like, I feel like the computer line, like, the Elf and the VIP, this is, like, really what your dad was most interested in out of all of these, like, 1802 projects and products.
Well, can I tell you, when you said the Elf was not an RCA product?
Yeah.
Well, if you're going to say that, the Microtutor and the VIP were not RCA products. Okay? What it was the same design by the same person, mm-hmm. with different capability depending on where the price point was. Okay. So, yeah, Elf was not made by RCA and sold by RCA.
Yes.
But the fact that my dad developed it and was able to convince RCA to make the Microtutor and the VIP, but he didn't want to pitch the Elf to them. Okay. He was adamant about that. And he was to tell me, I have to get the Elf articles finished and out there before RCA pulls the plug in the 1802. And in-house, they won't give me permission to publish anything about the 8, because you had to get clearance that it didn't, you know, you weren't, you know, scoffing at RCA products or anything. Not that they were cared about it, but that, you know, you weren't doing anything damaging to the RCA brand. He says, but if they stop making the 1802, the communications department is just going to say, no, we don't need anything published about the 1802.
Right,
they don't
right.
ever see the light of day. And I have to get it out there, because once it's out in the wild, even if you never get back copies are available, people have photocopied it and recirculating it, and it will never be able to disappear. They will always have access to it.
Sure enough.
And surprisingly, it was so popular that other people started making kits and selling them to you.
Yeah.
And at one point, my mother said, how come you didn't make a kit, and how come you're not suing them to not make kits? And I said, well, you're allowed to make kits, you know. He said, and you maybe I could threaten them. That they wouldn't know better. He says, but, you know, honestly, the possible money you might make off a kit is not worth the time and energy to run the kit selling company.
Right.
And he says, and if they can get this in the hands of more people without involving me and costing me any money, more power to them. I'd like to encourage as many companies who want to make variations on the Elf.
Let it be their problem.
Yeah, exactly. And I don't see anything about those companies that sold those kits that said, and they became this multi-million dollar juggernaut in the industry.
Yeah, they're all just like these little companies, like with names that are extremely 70s computer coded, like
right.
Like Neutronics and whatnot.
Right,
and,
right.
Like, and that's and all I've ever
in
heard
Australia
of them.
And in European countries that didn't even have a computer industry, but they had a computer magazine and hobby kits.
Yeah.
And again, they're nice family-run businesses. But if you already got a nice paying job at RCA and you have every free moment designing new products for them, and as Dad said, I get to work on my own ideas. They pay me a good salary to do it, and I have access to all their resources to see it as a product. What the heck am I going to do on a side gig trying to make money off kids?
Exactly. But, but use it for other things, too. So, like, the 1801 was used in the coin-op arcade system, which is very interesting because it, like, leads into this parallel development into, like, home video games.
Well, my father believed that he was not a scientist, okay? He was a control logic designer, computer designer. He said the difference is he wasn't interested in pure research.
Mm-hmm.
He was interested in the technology that... and how you would use that technology to get better products out in a certain product category. He said, so when RCA decided to make the 1802, they moved the people who were involved from Camden to the labs to work on it. And Dad said, but the labs is the research part with all the pure scientists, mm-hmm. and physicists in it. And he said, so I sort of felt that my role in that group of people was to develop a consumer product line that RCA could either produce themselves or license to other manufacturers. And that would be my contribution because I'm doing pure research,
right,
and everyone else is in the technology. So I could use designing products around it. And again, the pitch was RCA wants to be in the chip business. So they want volume sales of 1802s. They don't want to get into a new consumer product line.
Right.
Okay. So my dad's argument, because my dad wants as many consumer products as out there so that people will see them, wonder what's inside them, find out the iTunes, find out the Elf articles, and get into, hardware and software is a really cool hobby. So he wants the word out because this is advertising to say, hey, have you checked out things you can do with the 1802? There's a whole kit you can buy. And the pitch to RCA, again, was, okay, we know it's two small potatoes, even if we were next Pong. Pong is too small for RCA to bother with.
Right.
Okay.
RCA was huge.
right. And you're not ever going to make a dent in the bottom line. The rounding error on the rounding error is less, is bigger than what this would possibly be if you had a runaway bestseller. Get that. Okay. But he said, you look at it this way. You want to sell lots of chips. This is a new expensive chip. People have to understand how to use it. And there's a learning curve. If you consider the budget for the Fredtronic arcade game and the Studio 2 and the VIP and the MicroTutor, the development budget and the manufacturing budget as part of the advertising budget, it's actually a cheap way of getting the word out to the people who are likely to design equipment using the 1802 and be your potential customers in volume later on. Either they're people who are getting into engineering and future, they will already be familiar with the 1802 and therefore recommend it at their company, or they're self-studying and the company is talking about making people have to learn how to program a computer and they're avoiding it, and they bring home a video game or they play in an arcade and, they're technicalized, so they're interested and they find out it's an 1802-200. Oh, well, maybe I'll self-study and learn how to use that one. I'll keep, maybe I can keep my job that way. So... It's advertising, and it's the cheapest way to reach the target market you want. And the Pop Electronics articles should be approved for RCA for publication, because that's going to be the free self-training, self-study course that doesn't cost RCA any money to get the self-study course. So it was all geared towards, yeah, I think it was consumer products, but if you're not interested in it, how about we say this? if the budding product designers don't see examples of the kind of products you can do with an 1802, they may not choose an 1802 to do it with.
Which is very interesting that you, when you put it that way, because like the
Fred, make a little more sense about.
Because like the Fredtronic, this was like one of the very first arcade examples of using a microprocessor.
Yes, and it was the first one to use replaceable ROMs.
Yes, the designs talk about being able to swap cartridges out. I've seen a prototype of the sort of the successor of this was. Basically a consoleized version of the coin-op board, and that the cartridges for that are just straight-up video game cartridges.
Right. And again, the Spectre 70, as they were converting things over to semiconductors to replace printed circuit boards, those new cards plugged in. They had plug-ins printed circuit boards, and now plug-in boards with chips on it to replace those pieces because they weren't replacing the mainframe wholesale.
Yeah.
So the idea that you could swap things out. Of course, if you have something on a ROM, you'd want to put it on its own board and be able to plug it in and change it.
So, yeah.
So, I mean, inside RCA, it was not like anyone had to come up with the idea or sell it. It was like, well, we already designed things so that different printed circuit boards, things are on separate printed circuit boards that we're planning on putting on a chip so that when we do, we can just swap out the printed circuit board.
Yeah.
So why wouldn't we? Well, we're probably going to do the same thing if you're swapping out the memory.
Yeah. So it worked out great in terms of that technology. I mean, they did location tests of these things. Those did not work out great. I think you visited one of them, you've mentioned.
Oh, we took a field trip. Yeah. Dad found out where one of them was, and he said, well, you know, I want to see it. And it was at a little shopping mall and up in Feasterville and at an arcade called The Cave. And I have Tom's Hardware to thank for that, because they had a discussion thing about things that you miss around the area, and somehow, and Tom's Hardware had a thing with, and it devolved into like stores and things, and it got back to Tech, and it was like, oh yeah, I remember the arcade, the Cave Arcade at the Feasterville Mall. And I'm going, it must have been that one, because there's only one, and it wasn't like a big mall, it was like a strip shopping center with an aisle and another strip shopping center across the way, all under one roof.
One of those kinds.
Yeah, it wasn't any bigger than that. And on one end of it was an arcade. So I'm thinking, we went to Feasterville because I'm the one reading the map saying, okay, make sure we get off the right exits from New Jersey up north of Philadelphia, Philadelphia and find the right town. So I know it was Feasterville we were looking for. And we took a field trip, and we parked, of course, at the wrong end of the mall. So we had to walk all the way down on a Sunday. So hardly anybody there. And we walked down, and we see it, and there's hardly anybody in the place. And I don't know if it was plugged in or not, because my mother said, so you want to play a few games? He said, okay, I saw it, we can go. Mom said, wait, are you going to play a game? Play a few games? He says, I played the games on the demo system. I can play it at RCA on the box with the coin box disconnected. Why am I going to put a couple quarters in no machine to play the game just because it's out? I just want to see it, and, you know. My product is out in the public. And Mama said, well, we came all this. He said, yeah, but I can, you know, I could go down the Deptford and play the machines before they bring it out when they're testing them.
I have seen a photo from that test, and it was on in that photo, but I have read that another time they checked and it was powered off. And the guy's like, yeah, I don't know how to handle it. It looked scary.
Well, have you heard the stories I have heard about that?
I have heard that...
They were turned off because the people who control access to the business were afraid that if RCA is doing it, they would have no access to distribution. And, you know, and therefore they were not enthusiastic about them becoming very popular.
Read between the lines there, right, kids.
Yes.
The coin-op was
but
not...
Again, but again, RCA was not pushing it. Yeah. Because the point to have him out there was to have people who might be designing arcade games, because, wow, that looks like a great way for an electronics technician to make a fast buck. Let's build our, to see that they could be an 1802 base. So it was like, no great loss if you didn't have one.
But of course, you know, because it didn't work out, they reconsidered, like, all right, well, we can use the same technology for a home version.
Which I know.
Yes.
Just like the microtutor is the elf is the VIP.
Yeah.
It's just a matter of when it's cost effective. It was simultaneous development after the Fred of the Fredtronic and the Videomate, the original suggested name for the Studio 2.
A better name than the Studio 2.
Because if you look at them, they're both the same.
Yeah.
There are Fred with two, with the input for two control panels rather than one. And they're both identical. And my mother, my father made emphasis that he's having a hard time reminding everyone involved in breaking the arcade game that it's different. You can change the guts of it cheaply. The whole advantage is the arcade owner doesn't have to pay for a new box, a new cabinet and TV. Yeah. He reuses the old one. He just pays for a new ROM card. He says, because they keep suggesting box art for the games. He said, and I told him, you make generic artwork on the cabinet, and you've got these plastic slides that you can put the instructions and the artwork on the box in these places to mount the additional plaques and the instructions. And you make the control panel generic for as many times of games as you can. And if you don't use some of the controls for some of the games, it's okay.
Yeah.
Okay. But they keep showing me suggested artwork that goes with this game or that one for the cabinet. You're defeating the whole purpose that they repaint the cabinet. He says, so right there, he says, I see this is doomed. They don't get it.
Yeah. But very forward thinking, very much like kind of what it's like, you know, in the 70s when everything was TTL, like, yeah, you would have to like replace the whole machine. There were very few games that you could just like swap the board out. I think only Exidy made them.
But actually, you know, you can't blame the people who have that mindset.
Yeah.
Okay. Because when you're talking about early days of dedicated game players, the circuitry costs more than the box.
Mm-hmm.
So there is no reason to put all the expense in the custom printed circuit boards for a game if you're not going to have a box that advertises the game and some bland generic box, because the box is the least expensive component of the entire video game console.
Yeah, there's definitely a factor of like, okay, how do we actually attract people to like try this out?
They're coming from an era where, and the pinball machine itself is a lot less expensive than the pinball guts of it. So what do you care that you're not using it as an advertising platform? The best. It's not like it's a valuable thing you want to reuse on the next pinball machine, you know?
Right.
Next design. We'd like to reuse some of that artwork and some of the panels from the box. The box was the lowest cost part of designing a new pinball machine.
Yeah, you're not getting Spirit of 76-2 or something.
Right. Well, yeah, you don't have to say, well, we'll just repaint part of the artwork on the side and we'll use it for the new artwork. That'll save you anything.
Have a real need. Gotta sleep on your toes. And when you're on the street, you got to be able to pick out the easy meat with your eyes closed.
Yeah, based on the memos, you have like the Fred 3, which is the consoleized version, and then you've got the Videomate after that, following / Studio 2. These ones use the 1802. They're a little more compressed, I guess, form factor wise. You wrote a couple games on there. Well,
again, we go back to the VIP comes out just before the Studio 2, and so Dad wants games. They need example programs in it. RC doesn't want games because it's not professional, because it was pitched as a self study course for engineers to get into embedded microprocessor design.
Right.
And RC doesn't, they bought into that idea, they're going to go full tilt. Well, putting games in it would cheapen it and make it look like it wasn't a professional quality self-study course for engineers, and would cut into our sales, corporate sales for the training program. And my father had pitched it all as you know, might as well make it for self-study affordable for people to buy on their own if the company doesn't buy the training program, but it's still the materials you could use in the corporate training program. So they're focused on, it's a corporate training program thing, and in addition, we'll make it available to the public. Well, you have games in it. We're going to reduce our credibility as a professional study course that they'll pay for to have training in companies. That is darn. They really are focused on that. And I really can't now say, well, but you'll miss the hobbyist market. So he had to say, look, every demo we've ever done in-house has involved games. And it went fine. He says, here's the argument. He says, and I'm going to have to be sexist. Sorry, mom and you girls. But they bought it. It was like when the engineer wants to do it and his company won't buy him the training kit, it's cheap enough he can afford to buy his own. And when his wife says, well, if it's that important, why doesn't your company pay for it? Why do you have to pay for it? He can say, well, if I own it, after I'm done learning, it plays games and the kids will have something they can play games on. So it won't be a waste of money. And they bought that.
So that's how they got into video games.
So that's how the games got in the VIP manual. And because I wrote one of them, a couple of them that got in, when the Studio Cube came out, and RCA management said, okay, we need to say we have a game in these categories. And Dad said, got out of the meeting where they signed the categories. People said, I'll do that. He said, and no one volunteered to do the quiz for Random House. And he said, and I'm thinking, well, he does, okay, quiz game. You present the 147th question, you match it to the 147th answer. If they match, you add one to the score. If they don't, you go on to the 148th question. I can see why no one's volunteering to do that one. Exactly. You're not going to go, ooh, cool, you did the quiz game.
easy math.
Right. This really just looks like a tedious programming job that no one's going to volunteer for. And he said, so no one wanted to do it. And the other thing was, he said, we need a card game. And no one stepped up and said, okay, I'll do a card game. So I said, you know, my daughter got a couple of games in the VIP manual, so you know she can do them. Maybe you'd like me to see if she could do the quiz game, but next year she's going to college, so this time you'll have to pay her, not just credit. And they said, okay. And they said, minimum wage, $2.50 an hour. And they said, okay, maximum of 100 hours. And I said, okay. And they have to approve it. I do it on spec. If they like it, they'll pay for it. If not, I'll do it over again. I said, okay, that's good. He said, and by the way, if she had ideas for other games, would you look at them? And he said, yep, same deal, same price, on spec. And I say, so Dad told me that. And he says, so they really want the quiz game done, so I suggest you do that first and send it to them, because I don't think they'll look at anything else until that's done. And since they're looking for a card game, you might want to consider doing the card game next before you pitch anything else, since they're already looking for it. And I said, yep, sounds good. And then I sat down to design a card game on the limited graphics that it had.
I realized
why no one else had a great idea and was enthusiastic about doing a car race game.
Yeah, you got like your top-down racetrack and you've got the little squares racing around.
Right, on 32 by 64.
Yeah.
You know, that's the kicker. You know, it's like my father said, you have to sit down and think of the display before you commit to doing a game. There is no point in doing a chessboard when you don't have enough room for even 8x8, let alone the size sprites you'd need to distinguish the different pieces on a chessboard. And then two different colors. You only have two colors. So how are you going to do the white pieces and the black pieces? They're going to have some different shape or something on them, which means the sprites are even bigger. And you need 8 rows by 8 columns of them. So you really should look at display capabilities before you say, oh, I want to write a chess program. And it would surprise you how often people don't, because it's pretty high res, and they just assume there's plenty of space, but they don't look into it.
Whoops. Yeah, I feel like that would have been easier when they started working on the Studio 3, the backwards compatible version of the Studio 2 that had color.
Okay, again, just like it's the Bike Retooter Elf VIP is like one's, and the arcade game Studio 2 are one design with different variations. Studio 2, 3, and 4, and 5 are pitched at the same time. as one thing of that. We add features, then we actually produce it when it's cost effective. But we can design it in advance. And again, to convince them to do it, it's advertising for them of the kinds of products you can do. He said, we can reduce the cost by spreading the cost of tooling for the case across all of them, and they'll all use the same case.
Perfect.
Now, I'm not sure how that would have worked out for the Studio 5 home computer with floppy disk drives and a keyboard, but you know, again, by that time, if they're selling well and RCA is still in the business, they might spring for a new case.
That's future management's
right.
problem.
But right now, to sell the concept, it was you spread the development costs over many products, and that'll help keep the development costs low.
See, what I had heard from some of the other folks who worked at RCA is that, like, the Studio 3, the need for color really came out of seeing the Channel F at the Summer Consumer Electronics Show in 76.
Now, the need for color came from getting my father to agree that they should wait until color was cheap enough to do. And he said, it's hard enough persuading RCA to do. You have to constantly be trying to convince them. And the moment they say yes, you can't say, oh, thanks, it'll be 3 years before it's cost-effective to do what I just proposed. You have to say, okay, we're ready to go before they change their mind. Which means, right now, black and white is affordable. We go black and white and on the joysticks, okay? If you read the articles by the guy who designed the joysticks for Fairchild, and how long it took him and how many technical problems he had to solve. You understand when my father said, it's RCA. They're going to take a long time to develop keypads that are like telephone keypads that are reliable and rugged and things. Because the guys they assign it to are not going to have any sense of urgency about making a Christmas season sort of thing. You know, you're going to be selling keypads forever. No, you're not. And he said, and if you told them, solve the practical problems of a cheap, rugged, fine caliber, calibration joystick, it will take them 10 years to design it. So we might as well just wait till someone else has one and then just buy it from them. So right now, you get out what RCA can get out now, which is black and white with a keyboard. He said, and look, Pong is selling a lot. There are lots of games you can do that are Pong-like. And you're only waiting for the cost to come down on the color before this is obsolete and the color one comes out. So just get it out there while you can.
Yeah.
So, you know, people say your father was against color. Well, he was against color as being necessary before you ship. He said, you can do black and white screens for business computers. And IBM agreed. There was no color on the IBM PC. There's text in one color.
Right.
Okay. So, yeah, I mean, there's plenty of uses. And it's expensive to do color. Let's not wait to start selling the system. We'll sell another system when we add color.
And you know, RCA didn't sell this other system, but like an outfit in Hong Kong, Conic, which apparently was the largest electronics company in Hong Kong at the time, they licensed the Studio 3 and like all of these games to sell like in different parts of the world, which they did. And it was kind of prolific at the time. And I guess like the idea of like licensing out the 1802 technology did kind of work out for RCA in that instance.
Well, no, I see. Again, everything was licensing.
Yeah.
If their research didn't work out, anything you had breakthroughs along the way that weren't practical to that project, you could license to somebody else.
Yeah.
Okay. So it was licensing was a revenue source at RCA. It was legitimate. It wasn't like an afterthought. It was factored into any basic research project, which is why they did so much basic research.
Right.
Because they knew how they can monetize parts of it, just not how much. So it wasn't, whatever it cost to do pure research, it wasn't going to cost that much because of the offsetting.
Mm-hmm.
So again, Dad pitches the whole line of products. They're designing the color one while they're designing the black and white one. They're finalizing exactly what the printed circuit board should be while they're still producing the Studio 2. RCA cancels the product. Studio 4 is still just in the paper and pencil thing. And RCA management says, well, we got a product ready to go. Anyone want to license a product ready to go?
Here we go.
Right. And they find Conic. And Conic says, sounds good to me. You just drop this and we have to manufacture it. Yeah.
Yeah.
And I want to thank the community who has discovered that it is a Studio 3 and that everyone else is actually, the same computer under license from Konica.
Yeah.
Because they didn't find any documentation that RCA licensed it anyone else. They only licensed the Konica, and then other variations show up all around the world in other countries. So we're assuming, since we never have documentation of a scandal about cease and desist orders, that they were licensed from Konica.
The one that's very strange to me is the one that came out in Japan, the Toshiba Visicom, which is very interesting because it has like specific games to that platform that don't work on other Studio 2 and 3 machines.
Right. But again, in Japan, their RCA had a research lab in Japan.
Oh, really?
So there were RCA employees in Japan who probably had access.
So I wonder if that's where those games came from.
So they probably had people there who already had their hands on 1802s and all the documentation in-house for people who were doing demos and prototyping through the labs, and therefore was already enthusiastic. And when it became available, all they did was write their own game. You can write your own games for it. You just couldn't change the hardware on it if you're licensing it.
Yeah.
So it doesn't surprise me that Japan would have people who said, hey, essentially, homebrew games.
Yeah.
And let's start a company and let's take our homebrew Studio 2 games and sell them.
Let's run a sumo game on this machine.
Hey.
Which recently got dumped, and I really need to check that out because I want to know how the heck that works on that hardware. But, I feel like...
So, Lex, I want a shout-out to the community who discovered all of this and this mystery of where they came from and what they were, because it makes so much sense of what you see, and including, as you say, the Visicom. Why is that the only one with different software? Oh, Japan? You mean where RC had a research lab?
that would check out. Like, I've never made that connection, but, you know.
And I never would have brought it up, except people have said it was licensed thing, and you mentioned, oh, now that you look at it, the only one that's significantly different in the software is the one that happened to have a division of RCA? Maybe it does make sense.
Yeah. Oh, man. Wow, it's all coming together now.
Well, as I say, if you don't have the community of hobbyists digging into the facts and finding documentation and then disseminating the information, you can't connect the dots because someone else has to find more dots.
Yeah, and I feel like at this point, like, RCA of all companies, like, their video game efforts and computer efforts are probably some of the most well-documented because, like, you have all of this internal material, you've had people willing to talk about this stuff for years now, and you have a dedicated group of people in the community who are just like, okay, how does all of this, like, come together? Like, what does any of this, like, mean?
Can I just address that?
Yeah.
Okay.
By all means.
Right. It is a combination of factors, but I think I have a reason why it came together for RCA products. Okay. First of all, RCA made money off intellectual property, which means they documented everything going on RCA and kept the documents because you never know when there'll be a patent dispute.
They did love to litigate everything.
Whether it was research or part of a product, they were licensing pieces of it, if not the whole product to people, and they could, we're subject to something litigating it at any time. So they made you record everything, and they held on to it. So right there, that helps. So when the company went under, there was already that to be taken over by someone who would curate it. So it's not like some smaller company that they weren't keeping the records as they went because they were busy doing the products and they didn't have a legal department.
Right.
So that helped. And then on the second thing is, did you ever have the sheer joy of attending a retired RCA engineer's meeting?
Not a meeting, but I've certainly attended.
Have you hung out with groups of retired RCA engineers?
They are very chatty.
And they talk a lot about stories about RCA, and they're very interested
in stories about RCA.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? So the fact that there's a group out there, when the internet comes and you can cheaply publish your things, and there's an automatically affinity group of people who have an association either directly or through family members with RCA and have lots of stories about RCA to share, is just another serendipity.
Yep, yep. And there's always seems to be like new stuff to turn up, like the Fred 3 stuff that showed up a couple of years ago. Just earlier this year, I helped dump a prototype Studio 3 game called Space Explorer, or Studio 2. It was on a Studio 3 like plug-in card that got designed, but apparently Phil Baltzer, one of the other folks involved with the 1802 products, had this and took it home, and his family inherited it when he passed away, and they just recently sold it to a collector who wanted to get it dumped.
Right, so. And it does. Was it like nicer graphics?
I mean, it was a black and white.
No, I mean, but the style. Did it look like someone cared more about the graphics? I say that because there's a patent that the only patent of Dad's that has a co-author on it is a one with Phil Baltzer, and it has to do with graphics.
You know, it's funny.
Like 81, 82, near the end of the.
This was around 78, based on the date on the thing, and I did talk with the author of it recently, and he was like, yeah, you know, I was just messing around, like, they wanted games, and someone asked me if I could write one, and I put that together. But, I don't think it was good, but I wrote it.
I think with Phil Baltzer, since he was actively involved in developing some of the more advanced graphics chips at the end, probably the ones that went into the Studio 3.
Well, this one didn't have color implemented yet.
Right, but I'm just saying, because he was interested in that aspect of it,
it
wouldn't surprise me that he had some ideas for games and continued on when it wasn't a project and it wasn't likely to get into an official RCA cartridge.
Yeah. It was just very funny finding this. It's like, so how come Konic didn't license this game? Like, what about it? Were they pass?
Or didn't they know?
Or did they not know?
Did no one back in Deford at Distributor Parts and Special Services, when they were told, okay, we're discontinuing to pack up all the Studio 3 stuff and ship it to Konic, not know they had it?
Yeah, maybe.
No? Like the unicorn, it missed the boat.
Oh, well, I think we're coming up on time, so do you have any final thoughts on the sort of legacy with early computers and early technology gaming?
Well, I just like, again, shout out to the community that supports everything, because thanks to your efforts and many other people, ourselves and all, to get the information out there, I no longer dread Google searching for anything on this, because 10, 20 years ago, the things I would find were like, what was RCA thinking when? And I'd have to say, oh, God, I don't want to get involved in the flame war. I'm just going to ignore them. RCA wasn't thinking about any of this product line. They just wanted to sell semiconductor parts in CMOS to get licensing the CMOS technology to other chip fab places. So they wanted the biggest complicated circuit they could get on it to show, no, you can do a lot with CMOS. It's not limiting because the gates are big.
Look how cool it is.
And after that, it was all my father trying to convince them to get products out there in people's hands so that they would discover that it's easy to learn using an 1802 and have fun with it. Those were the two driving forces and everything. And RCA thinking about anything on those products have nothing to do with it.
Yeah. And you know what? I just find it very fascinating myself, like this whole history with RCA, like this giant of American consumer electronics, like sort of dipping a toe into this very small pond, like, which, as you say, is basically a rounding error on their overall, like,
it's
finances.
It's one piece of mist on the battleship.
Like, they're making so much money off of, like, TVs and litigation and patent fees and everything.
What people in RCA would call the real products, the real consumer products, records.
The stuff that funded their research lab, really. So, like, the fact that they, like, had any involvement in this space at all is just very interesting.
Well, I think the visual I would like the people to take away from this was RCA growing and growing, and then a 7-league boot, so they can walk over mountains as they walk. And unfortunately, they travel far enough into the future, and they are in the land of the Lilliputians, and they have no idea what to do with all these people under their feet. But, hey, there's money to be made down there, but they don't know how to get down there at that scale to make money with little startups. But they see there's a lot of little Lilliputians who are starting companies that are making a lot of money, but still not enough money to notice. But it's sort of like, oh, but they could use our license our technology to do it. Hey, Lilliputians, why don't you use CMOS to do that with? And Dad's there saying, ah, in your ear, sitting in his ear, saying, I think I know how to reach them. You want me to jump down there and talk to them? But I'm not going to tell you we're hobbyists.
I'm not going to tell you the specifics of how I'm
going to
tell
you, I'm going to help your corporate training program down with the with the mildly large people. But I'm going to drop down. I'm going to spread the word among the hobbyists. I think that's the visual that best captures it.
I think that's a good note to go out on. So thank you very much for joining me for this.
Thank you very much for letting me get that out there. And again, to thank all the people who enjoy this hobby so much and are willing to put the extra effort in to share it.
Okay. Do you have anything you would like to shill or promote before we sign
well,
off?
Well, I could mention my VCF East talk this year.
By all means.
And you'll be able to find it on the VCF YouTube channel in the future, was the Cosmic 1802 Control Logic Unit, how to program with a soldering iron, for people who would like to know how it's different designing a programmable circuit that executes a machine language instruction as opposed to just writing a simulator for machine language. And if anyone has any suggestions of things along those lines they'd like to see in next year's talk, contact Kevin and he'll screen them for something that you can say in polite company and pass them along to me.
Sounds good. I'll do my my stuff off the recording. I can just record that at home. So thank you very much.
Thank you again to Joyce Weisbecker for joining me on that podcast recording at the Vintage Computer Festival East. This has been Kevin Bunch. You can find me on Blue Sky at atariarchive.org, which is the name of my website, and also is my book that you can purchase now through Limited Run Games. It's Atari Archive Volume 1, 1977-78. I do talk about the Studio 2 a fair bit in there as well. And you've been listening to Retronauts. This is a Patreon-supported episode. This is a Patreon-supported show. You can subscribe to us at patreon.com/retronauts if you haven't already. At the $3 level, you get each episode a week early and at a higher bitrate. And at the $5 level, you get access to Friday bonus episodes, Diamond Fights weekly columns, as well as the Retronauts Discord server, which is full of great and fun conversations and people. So join us, won't you? And with that, thank you for listening.